and you're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org on the web. Upcoming, a special presentation sponsored by the Alzheimer's Foundation of America, and they are holding a free webinar for New York veterans and their families from 11 a.m. to 12 noon to provide them with information about brain health, memory screenings, and veterans benefits. Individuals can register for the free Brain Health Awareness for Veterans webinar at www.alzfdn.org/veterans. We're just about ready to go there right now.
Alzheimer's Foundation of America's National Brain Health Awareness for Veterans webinar. I am Donna Delavanti Raphael, and I am the director of the National Memory Screening Program here at the Alzheimer's Foundation of America. I will also be the facilitator for this event today. I would like to send a big welcome to the veterans and family members who are joining us at this event today. Let me throw out a little trivia for you. Did you know that there are over 90 million veterans here in America nationwide? Did you know that 50% of American veterans are over the age of 45? Actually, that's incorrect, over the age of 65. And did you know that 768,000 veterans are living with dementia? How about that 1 in 7 veterans over the age of 45 have reported that they're experiencing some form of memory problems? And that 1 in 3 veterans say that their memory problems are actually interfering with their everyday work life, their social events, and volunteering. Well, here at the Alzheimer's Foundation of America, also referred to as AFA, we've put together these webinars so that the veterans across America can be educated and empowered with this information. AFA wants you to know that we're here for you and you are absolutely not alone. On behalf of the AFA, I would also like to send a warm acknowledgement and thank you to our event sponsors, Eisai and Genentech, for supporting this event of the National Brain Health Awareness for Veterans series. I would also like to send a thank you and welcome to the listeners of WBAI FM radio here in New York City. So let's go over today's agenda for this event. The first guest, first of all, we have three guests. So the first guest speaker is going to be Jennifer Reeder. She is a licensed clinical social worker, and she is also the director of the Educational and Social Services Program at the AFA. She will be presenting the importance of brain health and early diagnosis for U.S. veterans. I will be the second speaker, and I will be presenting the importance of memory screenings. Our third speaker, who's a very special speaker, she is Jane Zalski, and she will be presenting VA benefit resources for VA vets. Now, please note, there will be a question and answer session after each speaker, so please put your questions in the chat box and we will answer them after we have done our presentations. Ladies and gentlemen, please allow me to introduce you to our first speaker, Jennifer Reeder.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, Donna, so much. And thank you, everyone, again for joining us today. So for the segment of the event at this moment, I will be sharing with you the importance of brain health and early detection of Alzheimer's disease. And while I'm going through this presentation, if at any point you have a question or a comment, I highly recommend that you go ahead and type it in so that when I get to the end of the presentation, I can go right into the questions. So I first want to go over with you the objectives for today's presentation. So I will be first talking about dementia and the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, because I think it's important for you all to have a good understanding as to what dementia is, what Alzheimer's disease is. Then I'm going to be talking about the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease among U.S. veterans, as well as PTSD. And then I'm going to describe the bidirectional relationship between PTSD and dementia. And then finally, I will help you all recognize the benefits of early diagnosing Alzheimer's disease. Okay, so first and foremost, what is dementia? So dementia is not a disease itself. It's an umbrella term describing a range of symptoms. And impact can be seen in the following areas of all the different types of dementia. So there's memory, judgment, motor skills, communication, and mood. And so dementia is caused by damages to the brain cells. This damage interferes with the ability of brain cells to communicate with each other. So when brain cells cannot communicate normally, thinking, behavior, and feelings can be affected. Now, unfortunately, at this time, there is no treatment that's currently available to cure dementia or to alter its progressive course. Yet there are numerous treatments that are being investigated in various stages of clinical trials. And there are also FDA-approved medications such as cognitive enhancing medications that are used to help slow the progression of cognitive symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. And then much, however, can also be offered to support and improve the lives of individuals with dementia, as well as their families and their caregivers. But what's important to note is that every type of dementia care plan must be tailored to the individual as well as their family, because how the different types of dementia affect an individual, it varies greatly from person to person. So now I'm going to talk with you about dementia types. So the different types of dementia include vascular dementia, there are additional types of dementia besides these, but these are the most common types of dementia. So there's vascular dementia that typically occurs after one large stroke or multiple small strokes. There's frontotemporal dementia, dementia with Lewy bodies. There's mixed dementia, which is typically a combination of vascular dementia and Alzheimer's disease, and then there's Alzheimer's disease. So Alzheimer's disease is a brain disorder that impacts memory, thinking, and language skills, and the ability to carry out the simplest of tasks. It is the most common form of dementia. So about 60 to 80% of dementia cases is Alzheimer's disease. And memory loss is often the first presenting symptom. Now, something I want to note there, though, is that even though memory loss is the first presenting symptom, many people don't seek a diagnosis or support until they start to experience additional symptoms, because in the beginning stages, a person's intellect is not affected at all. So they learn how to be able to navigate around this symptom of memory loss that they're experiencing. And then Alzheimer's disease is also, it's a chronic, progressive, and degenerative disorder. And there are two types. There's young onset and late onset. So young onset, also called early onset, that is not very common. About 5 to 6% of individuals with Alzheimer's disease have early onset, which basically means that you experience symptoms before the age of 65. And unfortunately, people can experience symptoms as early as their 30s and 40s. And it can also be a familial, which means it's a genetic mutation. And so that's most of the reason why there would be early onset Alzheimer's. Now with late onset, they're still trying to figure all of this out and trying to understand exactly why late onset occurs. Now Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. And unfortunately, the cause of death is due to all the complications that Alzheimer's disease causes. And in 2013, it was estimated that 5 million Americans aged 65 years or older had Alzheimer's disease. And this number may actually triple to as high as 13.8 million people by 2050. And that's according to the CDC. So what happens with Alzheimer's is brain cells degenerate and die, causing a steady decline in memory and mental function. And just so you all know what the warning signs of Alzheimer's disease are. So first we have memory loss, as I mentioned, but it has to be memory loss where it's disrupting a person's daily life. It's not just about, forgetting someone's name here and there. Confusion around time and place. This can lead to people getting lost very easily because they may be in a familiar place, but all of a sudden not know how they got there, not know what's going on. Difficulty completing familiar tasks. That can include sequencing. So someone may know exactly how to wash their car. This is something they do every Saturday, but all of a sudden they forget the sequencing on how, what the steps are to do that. There's also problem solving and planning challenges, misplacing things and losing the ability to retrace steps. This can also mean misplacing things and putting them in places such as car keys. Somebody puts them in the freezer where there's really no connection to where they put the object. Language and writing challenges, troubles comprehending visual images and spatial relationships. This can also include color contrast, where if there's a very dark rug on the floor, it may actually look like a hole in the floor to someone. Also, poor judgment, and unfortunately, these can be symptoms where someone can actually be taken advantage of very easily. Scam artists, telemarketers. Withdrawal from social activities. This is, very unfortunate because I think people start to feel that they just feel overwhelmed in the social gatherings that they used to be able to attend. Sometimes it's embarrassment because they're not able to do the things that they were able to do. And there's also changes in mood and personality. Alzheimer's disease, it causes confusion, suspicion of loved ones, depression, fear, and anxiety. So now since I've been able to give you a bit of an overview about Alzheimer's disease in general, as well as dementia, I now want to talk with you about how the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease among veterans. So according to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, 457,391, it was estimated that's the number of U.S. veterans that have Alzheimer's disease. And then 6.8% expected increase by the fiscal year of 2033. Now, approximately one-third of new cases are a direct result, and this is new cases among U.S. veterans, are a direct result of service-related injuries and other conditions. So that includes traumatic brain injury, successive concussion syndrome, blast-induced neurotrauma, and then also post-traumatic stress disorder. And I really want to dive in a little bit deeper about post-traumatic stress disorder because this is something of an injury that can't really be seen. It's almost like a collection of someone's trauma, and post-traumatic stress disorder are the symptoms of that collection of trauma. So I want to talk with you a little bit more about that. So post-traumatic stress disorder and dementia. In 2014, there was a study by researchers from the San Francisco VA healthcare system that found that veterans who were prisoners of war had a 50% greater risk of developing dementia later in life. And this is because all of the research and studies that they're doing, they're starting to recognize how stress seriously affects the brain and can lead to increased risk of dementia. And then so for people who also had a traumatic brain injury, this increased their chances even greater. And then in 2016, there was a study that found on average, the PTS prevalence rate among US veterans is 14 to 30%. Now, this is the varying numbers with this is it has a lot to do with the individual and their protective factors, what war they were in, as well as the level of support that they received from their community when they came back home. So bringing all of that together, in 2019, there was a systematic review that reviewed 25 articles pertaining to both PTSD and dementia. Now, current evidence suggests that PTSD and dementia have a bi-directional relationship. This means that PTSD can increase the risk for late onset dementia, just because, as I mentioned, all of the stress that what stress does to the brain and how it can make the brain much more vulnerable to dementia. And then also how dementia can increase the risk of delayed onset of PTSD in those who experience a significant trauma earlier in life. Now, this is because what they're finding is that people who had previously had gone through a trauma, you know, people, you develop coping mechanisms to deal with the trauma that you experience, the symptoms that you have. But unfortunately, as dementia affects the brain and slowly deteriorates the brain, it's also deteriorating those coping mechanisms. So people start to re-experience the trauma that they had gone through and in turn experience PTSD. So as you can tell, there is so much more to learn about and research on how experiences and traumas are connected to our physical health, our brain health. But what we can walk away with is the knowledge that to better understand how everything is connected within our bodies and our minds helps us to better advocate for ourselves, our care, and also how to communicate with our healthcare practitioners. Primary healthcare practitioners play a pivotal role in recognizing those who are at risk of Alzheimer's disease, yet we are also responsible for sharing our lifestyles and our habits and experiences that may indicate risk factors. So that's why it's really important to understand how stress can affect the brain so that we know that if we went through something stressful, we went through a trauma, even though we may think, oh, that's something to talk to a mental health practitioner or a mental health provider, it's also something to talk about with our healthcare practitioner because our mind and our bodies are all connected. So to talk with you a little bit more, then you can go to the next slide. So I just want to talk with you a little bit more about the benefits of early detection in Alzheimer's disease, because I think that there is a fear and a stigma that surrounds not only mental health, but also Alzheimer's disease. And I think mainly because there's a result of misconceptions about the disease and may prevent people from seeking medical treatment and receiving an early diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. But what we need to look at are the benefits of receiving an early diagnosis. So this includes, first and foremost, take control of your life. If you receive an early diagnosis, this gives you more time to be able to make those plans, legal plans, financial plans, long-term care plans, so that you are the one making those choices, not someone else. It gives you an explanation for your symptoms. As I mentioned before, Alzheimer's disease can cause disorientation, confusion, can even cause hallucinations and delusions. So it's really important for people to know what's going on with them so that they can start taking preventative measures. And so once we're able to start taking preventative measures, there are things that can be done to slow the progression of the disease. And then we want to be sure that we have access to the right services and supports, making sure that what we are doing for ourselves is in benefit for our future, for our health. For example, if someone does have a mental illness or if someone is experiencing PTSD and they're on a psychiatric medication, that is extremely dangerous for someone who has dementia. So this is why it's so important to be aware of your past, your present, and what to share with your healthcare practitioners. And then you can also have access to available treatments. There are so many treatments out there, but you can't have access to them without a diagnosis. And then we want to provide time for those who will support to prepare. Caregiving is an extremely important responsibility, and it's a huge responsibility. And people can become better caregivers and feel more confident about themselves being a caregiver if they have the time to be able to educate themselves and prepare on what it's going to take to be an excellent caregiver for their loved one. So then lastly, I just want to talk about what you can also do for your health. So although there is no prevention or cure, for Alzheimer's disease, a healthy lifestyle can improve overall health. So that includes eating a nutritious and low glycemic diet with vitamins C, D, E, A, all of the vitamins, including omega-3 fats, regular exercise, and maintaining a healthy weight. They're finding that insulin levels, what exercise can do for you over the course of 24 hours just by exercising for 30 minutes. Reducing stress as best as you possibly can. Keeping the mind active. Although there is no absolute evidence that doing any type of like cognitive exercise will reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease, it can benefit our overall well-being. And then watching your blood pressure and cholesterol. There's that head-heart connection. If we're not taking care of our bodies, then it's going to affect our brain. If you think about clogged arteries, that can lead to stroke, that can do vascular dementia. Keeping an active social life and broadening your social network as much as you possibly can. A good night's sleep is extremely important. Making sure you don't smoke cigarettes, that's huge. And maintaining regular checkups with your healthcare provider. And that includes, as I keep saying, making sure that you know how to advocate for yourself and what to communicate. And then finally, annual memory screenings. Annual memory screenings can really help to create a baseline for your memory so that you can go back every year and check and see how your memory is doing, if it's staying the same or if there's any kind of decline at all. So now, if there are any questions, I would be happy to answer those. So someone was asking me if I can provide a copy of the PowerPoint presentations. I would be happy to do that. Absolutely. Okay, so I'm just going to let you all know that if you do all have any other questions, and I do end the presentation before you're able to get your question in, you can always call our helpline. Our helpline is nationwide, staffed by licensed social workers who are thoroughly trained in dementia care, and so they're always there to answer any questions that you may have. The number is 866-232-8484. And we're always having new professional trainings about Alzheimer's disease, dementia. We have one coming up actually in May that's about psychological trauma. So I think we're all good with the questions. So I think I will go ahead and send you all over to Donna DeLavanti Raphael.
This is WBAI. In New York.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. I appreciate all that information that you shared with our veterans for today. We're going to talk about the importance of memory screenings. They can also refer to cognitive assessments. So let's start with memory screenings. So what is a memory screening? A memory screening is a simple, quick, and safe healthy brain checkup. And what it does is it's checking and testing for your memory and other thinking skills. It consists of a series of questions and tasks, or you can get, both. So some people ask, okay, is this only for people who are over the age of 65? Absolutely not. It is open to anyone and everyone. So if you are a person who is age 45 and you've probably seen one of your parents go through Alzheimer's or they've had memory issues, you may want to go and get either a memory screening or go to your physician and get a cognitive assessment. Okay, now if you're 18 and you've seen it and you have a history of this disease, you can also go to the doctor and get a cognitive assessment. So memory screenings are not an actual diagnosis, whereas a cognitive assessment is an actual diagnosis. That's why I mentioned about going to your doctor to get a cognitive screening or a cognitive assessment. So what this does, because it's not a diagnosis, what it does is indicate to you what you can do, and also indicates that you probably need to go to physician, to get a proper medical checkup. Okay? Memory screenings, they are absolutely confidential. They are not shared with the government. They are not shared with your physician. They are not put on your driver's license or anything like that. It's literally a conversation with the testing going between you and the person who's giving the test. So why get a memory screening? Everybody wants to know why to get a memory screening. Well, it's important to get a regular brain checkup. We call it a healthy brain checkup because it doesn't mean that you have Alzheimer's. It doesn't mean you have any form of dementia. It just means that you may be experiencing some sort of memory issue, a little bit of memory loss, or a little bit of confusion, and you may want to just have that checked. So it's important to get these healthy brain checkups. We like to do it like every other screening, health screening, such as blood pressure, cholesterol. You want to make sure that when you go in, you say what it is that you need, And that will absolutely help you and, you know, assist you in getting to that goal. Having a healthy baseline, it's important. Why? Because you're getting screened on a regular basis, and it can help you decide and identify where you are today and where you'd hopefully like to be tomorrow. But what it does is it's just checking your potential memory problems a whole lot sooner. Early diagnosis, and I think Jennifer had mentioned that before, early diagnosis is it's checking for all types of memory problems. So it could include thyroid problems, it could include vitamin deficiencies, stress, medication complications, it could be drugs, it could be smoking, it could be high blood pressure, it could be diabetes. I mean, there are just so many factors that can make you have memory problems, okay? So, potential signs of memory problems, and I believe Jennifer has already gone over some of them. Some of the memory problems are memory loss that interrupts your daily life. So, for example, if you are a person who likes to cook and you are going from what you remember up here, and all of a sudden, one day, you really can't remember, is it the salt or is it the sugar that you put in that cake? Start questioning, okay, is something going on? Why did I forget? Okay. Also, if you have trouble concentrating, sort of saying you're reading a book and you can only get to the first page and you're an avid reader, then maybe you should look at it and why am I feeling this way? Why am I not being able to concentrate? Difficulty performing familiar tasks. So if you are a person who sweeps on a regular basis, you sweep that living room every day, it takes you 5 minutes, but today it's taking you 30 minutes, even though you haven't left that broom. Question that. Why is it taking you so long, right? Because the brain and the arms, everything's supposed to work together, but if it's not, then you need to look into that. Trouble recalling names, especially names of family members and friends. Trouble recalling words, simple words that you use on an everyday basis. Also forgetting where you are and where you are going. So if you are, for example, going to a mall, and when you get there, it does not look recognizable to you, or you pull up in the parking lot and you're just like, where am I? Then you need to have that question with yourself on what's going on. Maybe I need to go and get a memory screening or a cognitive assessment. Forgetting where you're going, you know, you walk out the door and you say, yeah, I'm going for my regular walk, and it's 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the afternoon. You want to take that walk. It's in the neighborhood. You get to the stop sign and all of a sudden you forget where you were going. Then you need to question that. Now, I know that sometimes we'll be at home and we have a quick thought of, okay, I need to go into the kitchen because I want to get a spoon. And then when you get to the kitchen, you totally forget that you wanted to get a spoon. That is not Alzheimer's. That is not memory loss. That is simply how we function as we get older. There are just some things that change, but it's not a permanent change. It's a very, very temporary change. Repeating the same things over and over again. And if you've ever known someone with Alzheimer's, you will see that, and it's very repetitive, and you need to know how to change it. Okay, misplacing things more often and not being able to retrace your steps. That is also a very, very big sign when it comes to memory problems. You need to be able to retrace your steps. So if you are putting the keys, and you know, you usually go home, but in my case, I'm always so busy. So when I get home, I have to think about the child, the dog, and everything else that I have to do. And sometimes I put my keys in the freezer, but I know I have to cook dinner. So, hey, I remember, oh yes, wait a minute. I put the keys in the freezer. I need to take the meat out instead of take the keys out. So we look at things like that. Also getting lost when you're walking or driving, which I mentioned before. Family and friends start commenting on changes with your personality, your mood, your behavior, and your desire to be active and participate in life. And then the last one would be confusion in time or place. And what does that mean? So there's a time when people will, for example, I used to live in Florida, and you would see in the dead of the heat in August, you know, June, July, August, and someone's wearing a winter coat and they're taking a walk. That's when you question, wait a minute, something might be wrong because they're in the wrong season. The brain is not here in the summer. So you want to take a look at things like that. What am I doing differently? What is that loved one of ours doing differently? And then you want to be able to, you know, do that memory screening. And if it gets very severe, go and do a cognitive assessment with your physician. Okay? So where to get a memory screening? That is always the question, because people get excited. They're saying, this is not so difficult after all. It's not something to be ashamed of. Absolutely not. But where do I go to take that next step, take that action? So the first thing here at the Alzheimer's Foundation of America, we have a program. It is online, and we call it the AFA Memory Screening Test. And I believe on site on the screen, you'll be able to see the link. So you can go on there. It's absolutely free of charge. It takes about 5 to 10 minutes. It depends on how far you go. And it's very easy to set up. So you'd go on afamemorytest.com. Now, if you decide you want to do this in person, due to COVID, a lot of the physicians are not doing, in-person testing. However, if you call our line, the 866-232-8484 number, you can request a virtual memory screening. Now, this virtual memory screening is about 10 minutes. You have a qualified person to take this test, and they will go over the questions and answers with you, and then they will give you your feedback. Okay, right at that time, they will also give you your score and what you should do next. Now, when it comes to the physician's office, I might want to add that if you are over the age of 65, and just like you would go in for a blood pressure test or a diabetes screening or any of those kinds of health screenings once a year, you can also do the same for the cognitive assessment. Just ask for it. But when you ask, you need to make sure that your doctor, your physician knows that this is something that you are supposed to get. Do not let yourself get, carried away with, oh, he's in a rush or anything. Ask for it. It is okay. It is covered by your insurance, and they know how to do the billing, but you have to ask for it. Okay? So, what do you do after a screening? So you've gotten your memory screening, and you've heard the score, and you're figuring, okay, what does this actually mean for me? So if the results indicate there's a memory problem, and we would, of course, tell you, what we would recommend is that you meet with your doctor. It's not an urgent matter, but you need to meet with your doctor as soon as possible. Now, if your results are okay, and you still have some concerns, we would also recommend that you meet with your doctor. Again, not urgent, but meet with your doctor. Have the discussion. Now, if your results indicate that your memory is healthy, we will always recommend that you come back in another 6 months to a year and do another memory screening just to see where you are from the first time you did it to the next, occasion that you actually do your screening. So, benefits of early detection when it comes to your brain health. Not all causes of memory loss or memory problems are related to Alzheimer's. There are many conditions that cause memory loss. They're actually treatable, or in my case, I might say reversible. Those include things like, as I mentioned before, vitamin deficiencies, thyroid conditions, UTIs, urinary tract infections, stress, anxiety, medication side effects, depression. These are all things that if you go to your physician, they can provide you with some sort of medication or some sort of therapy, whether it be drug therapy or non-drug therapy, and you'll be able to, use that and feel a little bit better and know that it is not Alzheimer's. But you need to make sure that you have these conversations with your physician so that you can get the proper help. Now, in the case that it is Alzheimer's disease, an early diagnosis or early detection will actually help you. Why? Because four things. You can begin any medications and manage the symptoms earlier, because the medications that are actually out there to manage the symptoms when they are in the early stage, not when you get to the late stage. So they are absolutely more effective. The second situation is that you can maximize opportunities to participate in clinical trials. The importance of clinical trials is that once you participate in a clinical trial, it adds to the gap in the literature when it comes to, this is what we need to do. This is how many people are having Alzheimer's. What is it that is causing the Alzheimer's? What can we do to either reverse it, cure it, treat it, but that's your contribution to finding a cure. The next is utilizing non-drug interventions that can help to slow or delay the progression of the disease. And the final one is you have a greater input in developing your own care plan, and that is vital because it includes both legal and financial matters. And there's nothing worse than when you can't have the input into how you want to be cared for and how you want to see things in the future as you progress. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe I am done with that, but I wanted to make sure that you understand that the AFA is here to help you. And, you know, when you have more questions about memory screenings, please give us a call at 866-232-8484. Or you can go on our website. It's alzfdn.org. Or you can call for a memory screening at the 866 number I mentioned before. Or you can go online and get your free memory test at afamemorytest.com. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, now I would like to say that there is an opportunity for you to ask questions. Please do your questions and put your questions in the chat box. Okay, I have a few questions here. Great. Okay, so the first one is, do you keep records of the memory screenings? We keep them in our files, but they do not have information on them that can identify who you are. We do not share them with any physicians. We do not share them with anyone actually in the rest of our office. So it's just myself and our team, and we keep that information private. The next question is, how do you get a copy of a memory test? That is something that we can provide to you. We can either send it to you via your email, or we can just do a verbal discussion on what the actual score is. Now, if you go to your physician and you get a cognitive assessment, then they can give you that information also directly. The next question is, can anyone get a cognitive assessment? Does insurance cover this? Yes, anyone can get a cognitive assessment. When you go into the physician, the first thing they're going to ask you, of course, because we are here in the United States, is where's your insurance? So cognitive assessments, if you are over the age, are you 65 or over the age of 65, absolutely insurance covers it. You just have to let the doctor, the physician, whoever you're speaking to at that office, know that you want to have a cognitive assessment. I would recommend that you make that appointment, that when you're making your actual appointment to go in, you let them know from there on the phone that you want this cognitive assessment, because it takes a little bit longer in their office and they need to put that time aside. As for the insurance, yes, they know how to do the billing. They have all the billing codes, and that is not something you need to worry about. Now, if you are under the age of 65, you will have to speak to your insurance company to find out if that is something that they will cover for you. The next question is, for annual memory screenings, is this by your PCP or a neurologist? Or is this done by our PCP or a neurologist? So let me give you here at the Alzheimer's Foundation of America, we are professional social workers. We also do memory screenings. We are not PCPs and we are not neurologists. We do memory screenings. Now, if you go to your physician, or also known as PCP, you will get a cognitive assessment. So the cognitive assessment is an actual diagnosis for where you are with your brain health. What that physician will also do is, after they've done that, the next step that they're supposed to put you through is to put you through to a neurologist, whether it be someone that they are in contact with or someone that is close to you. And it's usually a neurologist who knows about cognitive assessments, knows about Alzheimer's and any form of dementia. So it goes that route. So I hope I've answered your question there. The next question is, are there memory screenings that we can do on our own, or do they require a practitioner to do? So we have an online memory screening that I mentioned earlier. That one is, it does not give a diagnosis, but it just gives you the score as to regarding the test that you do at that moment. You can do that as many times as you want. It is free of charge. As I mentioned before, you go to afamemorytest.org and you'll be able to see that screening. As for the practitioner, when it comes to cognitive assessments, again, it could be a nurse, it could be a social worker, a licensed social worker, it could be a neurologist, it could be a therapist, a psychologist, or a psychiatrist who can give these cognitive assessments. But the one that you probably want to go to first before you sort of jump way over into the deep end is your physician. The final question is, do you record the memory test? No, we do not record the memory test. It is private, and we do not have any place that we can store all of those tests, and we would be responsible because it would create a problem if someone was able to get access to that test. So we do not store them, or we do not record them. We do store them, but not record them. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I think that is it for the questions. Is there any more questions? No? Okay, perfect. Thank you so very much. I hope I was able to share with you all the information that you needed to know about memory screenings. And I would like to introduce you to our very special guest, Jane Salsky. Jane?
Hi, good morning. My name is Jane Salsky. I work for New York State Division of Veterans Services. It's important to understand that I am not a VA employee. A lot of people get us confused with that. I'm a veteran benefits advisor with New York State Division of Veterans Services. So that just means I help veterans work with the VA pretty much. So who New York State Division of Veterans Services is, if we can go to the next slide. Okay, so New York State Division of Veterans Services was established after World War II to help veterans, you know, men and women coming home from the service, coming home from war, to navigate really all the paperwork with the VA. You know, the VA, it's just huge, and there's a lot of paperwork, there's a lot of red tape, and so me as a veteran benefits advisor, And people like me, we help you guys, we help veterans and their families navigate all of that stuff. Because there's so much stuff out there, it's really hard to know unless you do it every day. And even when you do it every day, there's still a lot you don't know. So our mission is really just to help veterans. We advocate for them, we assist them, the veterans, the family members, and anybody really who can help a veteran. Next slide. Okay, so this is a veterans benefits briefing, and I'm gonna be very brief because I only have 15 minutes. We're gonna talk first about state benefits and then about federal benefits. The important thing though is at the end of the slideshow, there's gonna be a phone number to call if you wanna schedule an appointment. Because every single veteran situation is different, and you're going to talk, you know, in the veteran circle, you talk to people who have 100% disability, or they have this, or they have that, and some veterans don't understand why they don't have the same thing. So it's important to talk to a veteran service officer and let them discuss what benefits you may be eligible for. So just very quickly, just running down the state benefits. There's a blind annuity. That's a monthly payment for veterans who are legally blind or their surviving unremarried spouse. So if you know a veteran, if you know a veteran who's legally blind, there is a New York State benefit where they can get a monthly payment. If the blind veteran passed away, their surviving spouse can apply for it. There's a Gold Star parent annuity. That's an annual or biannual payment for Gold Star parents. A big one that we get asked about a lot is the property and school tax exemption. That's depends on whether or not you're a Cold War veteran, a wartime veteran, if you're a disabled veteran. So you want to talk to, you want to take your DD-214 to your tax assessor's office. Pretty sure the cutoff for most towns is March, but if you get it in there now, you can get it for next year. And that's different from the the STAR exemption. So that has nothing to do with the STAR exemption. It's totally different. There's a veteran, the Homes for Veterans program. That's a discount you get for home mortgages. There's a supplemental burial allowance. So this is for veterans who died on active duty. The high school diploma for veterans who joined the service before receiving their high school diploma. Basically, they quit school so that they could go to war. So they'll give veterans a honorary diploma for that. Veteran tuition awards, that's college money for qualifying eligible veterans. There's the military recognition scholarships. That's, again, college funds. Regions awards for children of vets. There's a hunting and fishing license discount. So that's for veterans 40% disabled or more. Employment section 55C. That's pretty much, that's a program where if you're a disabled veteran and you have not taken a civil service test, but you are otherwise eligible for that job, you can apply and possibly get that. You know, you'd have to go through the application and interview process, but you could possibly get that job without having to take that test. There's a New York civil service point. So depending on whether you're disabled or not, you get 5 points if you're not disabled, 10 points if you're disabled. There's five nursing homes. There's five New York State nursing homes run that are veteran homes. So we're going to talk about that in a later slide. And then there's a lifetime Liberty Pass. That's for veterans 40% disabled or more. They get a free pass for any state or any park in New York State, any state park, I should say. So I know I kind of ran through them briefly, but this is something you, if you went to our website, if you just Googled New York State Division of Veteran Services, all of these would be listed on there. Or again, you can call one of your veteran service officers and they'll help explain this in more detail. Okay, so moving on to federal benefits. There's two big federal benefits that we do a lot. And this is what we're asked about most often. Compensation, veterans compensation, sometimes it's called disability compensation, service-connected compensation. But this is a monthly payment based on your service connection. So usually it's service connection disability, but I don't like to use the word disability. Like earlier when I was saying 40% disabled veterans, 100% disabled veterans, I don't really like to use that word disability because it's compensation is a monthly payment for medical conditions that are caused by your time in service. When we use the word disability, that's the VA's word, but there's a lot of medical conditions that can be service connected that your time in the service may have caused that is not necessarily disabling to you. So that's why I don't like to use that word, like tinnitus or tinnitus. That's the ringing and the buzzing in your ear. Most people wouldn't consider that a disability, but it is compensatable. So the biggest thing about compensation to know is that you should speak to a veteran service officer specifically about your time in service and what you may be eligible for. Even if you've been out of service for 40 years, 50 years, it's something you may be able to be service connected for. A lot of times we request those records from your medical records from the National Archives. And then we can go through them and see if you have anything that you were treated for that maybe you don't remember ever getting treated for. If you were a mechanic or you were an otherwise loud, exposed to loud noise, you may be service connectable for hearing loss. And I understand that's not really the subject for today. It's not related to dementia, but people with dementia, you know, they have added medical expenses. So any extra money that you can get each month is beneficial. So Also, if you may have PTSD or some other mental health condition that might be service connectable, and if you're diagnosed with PTSD, and we can get that PTSD service connected, meaning that your PTSD was caused by your time in service, or your anxiety was caused by your time in service, or your depression was caused by your time in service. And if any of the mental health conditions that you have cause dementia, like if your doctor is willing to say, oh, her PTSD caused her dementia, or contributed to her dementia, then we could get the dementia service connected. So it's a lot. It's a lot to cover in 15 minutes. So really, again, at the end of the presentation, write down the phone number and call just to speak to a veteran service officer and make an appointment. Okay, so the next big federal benefit is pension. Again, this is a monthly payment. It's based on need. We do not say it's based on income, because you could have a very high income, but you can have higher or very high medical expenses that bring that income, you know, what you have to live on, so far down that you may qualify for pension. So pension is something that compensation is a higher benefit. It's more money every month, but not everybody qualifies for compensation because they may not have disabilities. So, or medical conditions related to their time in service. But pension is something veterans or their surviving spouses may qualify for. So if you know somebody who's having a hard time making payments, you know, having a hard time financially, and they're a veteran, they may qualify for this. Excuse me. Aid in attendance. Now, I don't know how many veterans here are enrolled in VA healthcare, but a lot of times the nurses and the medical staff will say, oh, you need to apply for aid in attendance. There's like five different things that people refer to as aid in attendance. So the two big things is compensation is, again, related to its medical conditions that were caused by your time in service, right? If that medical condition is causing you to need extra care, so you need aid and somebody there attending to you, you can qualify for a higher level of compensation. And then it's the same thing for pension. If your medical expenses bring down your income, or your income is so low that you qualify for pension, and then you also need help with your activities of daily living, you can get a higher level of pension. So that just means more money every month. So aid in attendance is for people who need daily assistance with activities of daily living. That's things like hygiene care, managing your finances, managing your medical pills and stuff like that, feeding yourself, cooking for yourself. A lot of people can still feed themselves, but they may not be able to manage, you know, the oven and the stove and stuff like that. So they may qualify for aid in attendance. And then there's VA healthcare. We don't really so much help veterans apply for VA healthcare. But you can call this number, 877-222-8387. You can apply that way, or you can apply online, or you can apply in person at a local VA medical facility, or you can mail in your application. Personally, I recommend you call and speak to somebody, or you do it in person. Don't mail the application in. God knows where it'll go. Don't mail it in. Okay, so that's just a brief covering of the federal benefits. We're going to cover a few more things here with survivor's benefits. So dependents indemnity compensation, it's called DIC. A lot of times people just abbreviate it DIC. That's the surviving dependents benefit. So if a service member who is service connected for something dies from a service-connected disability, or they were service connected at 100% total and permanent for 10 years or more before their death, then the spouse, surviving spouse, or surviving dependent children may qualify for a monthly payment based on that. So for a surviving spouse, it would be for the rest of his or her life. For dependents, it would be till they were out of college or high school if they don't go to college. Death pension is, again, needs-based. It's for the surviving spouse. It's for surviving spouses of veterans who passed away, and that surviving spouse has a financial need. There's CHAMP VA. This is like, it's not VA healthcare. It's healthcare through the VA, but you don't go to the VA. You would go to a private facilities, and this is for dependents, for veterans who are 100% permanent and total disabled.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Our newscast is coming up. You're just listening to a special presentation from the Alzheimer's Foundation of America, hosting a free webinar, a health awareness webinar for New York veterans. And we are, in fact, out of time. If you'd like more information, please go to www.alzfdn.org/veterans. Certainly thanks to Jennifer Reeder. We'd like to thank Donna DeLevante, Raphael, and Jane Zalski, who you're just hearing from now. The toll-free helpline is 866-232-8484. And we thank you so much, and thanks again to Sandy Silverstein. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web, and let's get ready to go now to our newscast.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. President Biden on Monday lifted the annual limit on the number of refugees who can be admitted into the United States through September to 62,500. Biden drew a wave of criticism from supporters for initially keeping the record low cap of 15,000 set by the Trump administration. Biden noted what he called the sad truth that reaching that number of admissions by September will be hard to achieve given the challenges of rebuilding a system President Trump had dismantled. Biden reinforced his goal of 125,000 refugee admissions for the fiscal year that starts in October, but cautioned that that number will still be hard to hit. This news comes one day after it was announced the United States will begin reuniting migrant children with their parents this week. Four families that were separated at the Mexico border will be reunited in what is just the beginning of a broader effort that will stretch on for months and possibly years as separated parents are brought back to the United States from around the world. More than 1,000 families remain apart, according to the Department of Homeland Security. The parents were deported alone, mostly to Central America, in 2017 or 2018. Their children have since grown up with relatives across the United States. Immigrant advocates welcomed the announcement, but expressed frustration at the slow pace of reunification. Family members and civil rights leaders mourned Andrew Brown Jr. yesterday at an invitation-only funeral. The event was held 2 weeks after the black man was fatally shot outside his North Carolina home by deputies serving search and arrest warrants. The event was as much a call for justice as a goodbye. Speakers included Brown's sons, as well as civil rights attorney Ben Crump, who is representing Brown's family. Calling Brown's death an unjustifiable, reckless shooting, Crump told mourners the legal team would continue fighting for justice and transparency. In his eulogy, the Reverend Al Sharpton issued a powerful call for the release of body camera footage. This comes after last week a judge ruled against making all the deputy's body camera videos public, a decision that angered the family and civil rights leaders. A trial began yesterday in a lawsuit filed in West Virginia accusing three drug distributors of fueling a local opioid epidemic with excessively large shipments of painkillers over several years.